as the truth. Let's welcome Abdu Murray this morning as he shares with us on how we as men of God can be equipped with truth. Welcome him, please.
Thank you. Well, good morning, gentlemen. It's great to be with you all. What an honor and a pleasure. And it's funny, when I get introduced, and it depends on what state I'm in. Sometimes when I get introduced in Ohio, I don't even include my bio. No educational background necessary to say he got a bachelor's degree in this and he got a law degree, and that's good enough. Here it can be polarizing too, and so to get the other half of the audience happy, my son is a Spartan and my wife's a Spartan. So there you go. Now I'll get everybody clapping for me. I have two more kids coming up, so we'll see. We'll see. We're just hoping for no Buckeyes. So there you go. But it's a pleasure to be with you all today. What I do want to get through, I got a lot of material. You've seen it in your packets. I got some stuff. It's some heady stuff, you know. And so Saturday mornings can be a little bit tougher to sort of get our minds unfogged from the week that we've had at work or other things we've been doing. But it's 11 o'clock, so you have no real excuses. my friend Crawford Loritz always begins sermons where he says, look, let's just get this out of the way. If you're sleepy, just go ahead and sleep. The reason he says that is because what ends up happening is that you'll do one of these numbers the whole time, and that's distracting to a speaker. I notice a lot more than you think I notice. That's what he says. He says, otherwise, someone's going to nudge you or whatever. And he says, and don't do this one. Don't do the whole thing where you like you're praying, but you're really asleep. He says, now we're getting into violating commandments and bearing false witness and this kind of stuff. So just go ahead and fall asleep. I'll be okay with it. Hopefully you won't, but if you do, I understand. I've been in your seat before. But I want to speak to you on this idea of clarity in a culture of confusion this morning. A very tough subject in the sense that we can't afford to not pay attention. And I think that given the sort of cultural sway right now in various areas of what it means to be a Christian, what it means to be human, Christian or not, and all these things, there's a lot of serious, deep questions we have to wrestle with, questions we didn't used to have to wrestle with, that we thought were sacrosanct, that we thought were solidified, that we thought didn't have to be reinvented. You know, for example, what does it even mean to be human with the transhumanist movement that's out there now? And I don't mean transgender, I mean transhumanist, with the idea that with the advent of AI and the various things we can do now with technology, we're looking to enhance human beings in a way that suggests that maybe we're not quite complete, that something's wrong with us, even if nothing's actually wrong with us. So we don't want to just use AI and implants and these kind of things to help someone who has an atrophied limb or who's lost a limb. We actually want to take your current perfectly fine limbs, augment them so that you can jump higher, run faster, do whatever it is, or augment your brain to be able to access things it couldn't access otherwise. And so there's this idea, too, is being human good enough anymore? If you can't afford those things, do you become less of a human because you can't afford to enhance yourself chemically or mechanically? Then we have the question of what it means to be male or what it means to be female. I mean, we even have the question, and it's very pertinent for this room, about what it means to be a man. You know, we have phrases like toxic masculinity. And we have varying and very vague definitions of what toxic masculinity actually is. Is toxic masculinity being assertive? Is it being forthright? Is it being, you know, sort of strong in a certain situation? Or do you have to be gentle, quiet, sit in the corner and stop talking? You know, who knows what this word actually means? And it kind of depends on the person saying it. We're asking you, what does it mean to be married? What does it mean for life to begin? When should life end? How should life end? Can we end life on our own terms? Or do we have to actually accept the natural course of death? These are the questions we're actually asking now, which once were the kind of things that you took for granted as answered, and they're no longer answered. Everything is up for grabs. You know, it reminds me, I do a lot of traveling. As has already been stated, I've traveled all over the world. And I've spoken at major universities all over the place, not only here in America, but also in Canada, in South America, and other parts of Asia and the UK and Europe. And I've noticed something. These questions are up for grabs everywhere. It's not just here. It's not just in the West. There's these issues everywhere. So it reminds me, you know, I speak a lot internationally, and sometimes when I speak internationally, I get to go to Canada, which sometimes requires a flight, and sometimes just requires a drive. And normally when I go, I either go through Sarnia and I go to the Blue Water Bridge up there, or I go through the Windsor Tunnel or whatever it might be. But this particular speaking engagement was in a town called Wallaceburg. I'm not sure if you're familiar, but there was an open-air event, and there was a big sort of like big old-fashioned tent revival meeting, and the tent was about as big as this room, twice as big as this room. And I was like, wow, that's a big tent. So I was going to drive there. Now, you need to know this about me in order to get sort of the gist of the story. I'm terrible with directions. Absolutely atrocious with directions. I'm not even quite sure. I'm pretty sure this is the north entrance of this building, but I'm not quite sure. They said, go to the north entrance. I'm like, that doesn't help me in the slightest bit. I'm obsessed with my GPS, which has made things worse, by the way, because now I rely on this machine all the time, so my already bad sense of direction is just atrophied over time. So back in the day, you didn't have unlimited data plans on your phone and all this stuff, so you didn't use your GPS on your phone as much as you would like to have done it, so I have one on my car. So I drive, I'm going to go to Wallaceburg. I don't go through the Blue Water Bridge, nor do I go through the tunnel in Windsor. I go across, there's this car ferry. I don't know if you know this, but in Algonac, you can take a car ferry across over to Canada. Now, we're all Great Lakes States people. When I say car ferry, you're thinking of the one in Muskegon. You're thinking of these, or the ones that get you over to the UP or whatever, these big, massive boats that can hold dozens of cars. That's not the kind of car ferry I'm talking about here. The kind of car ferry I'm talking about would probably fit on this stage. It was this white, rickety boat is a loose term, for this thing. The paint's peeling off of it, all this stuff. I half expected the guy to pull me across the river like Lord of the Rings style with like a rope or something. So I pull up onto this car. I'm the only passenger. And the good thing, because it holds two cars, maybe. I get onto this thing, and the guy says, okay, we're going to go across. Won't be a long trip. Just stay in your car. It's a blazing hot summer morning. I didn't want to get out of my car, and I could enjoy the air conditioning. So just stay in your car the whole time. I'm like, great, no problem. So because I'm obsessed with my directions and I'm thinking about, I'm going to go into Canada, I want to make sure my GPS is functioning, I have the right address in. When I cross over into Canadian waters, is it going to get wonky? I don't know. So I'm sitting there and I'm looking at my GPS the whole time, just laser focused on it. GPS, GPS, GPS. And my looking down at the GPS, I couldn't see us leave the dock. Because I was in the car, the mass of the car and the suspension of the car absorbed the energy of us leaving the dock. So I didn't feel us leave the dock. So I didn't know we had left. So when I looked up, I had that momentary vertigo you have where you are sitting at a street corner and there's a bus next to you and the bus goes forward and for that split second, you don't know if the bus is going forward or you're going backward. And you get this panic, like, I'm gonna kill somebody. So you press on the brake a little harder. What do you do in that moment? In that moment, what you do is you look for something solid, something that doesn't move, some fixed point of reference. You look for a mailbox or a streetlight or a building or whatever it might be that you know doesn't move so you can tell if you're moving relative to that thing. And in that moment, all the vertigo goes away and the confusion goes away. It's cleared up and you know what's happening. Well, I was on a river. Everything's moving. And the boat won't help me because the boat is the thing that's moving. So I had this vertigo for quite some time. It wasn't until I saw the distant shore sort of getting bigger in my field of vision that I realized, okay, we are in fact moving, and the vertigo and the nausea sort of went away. I feel like culture is in that river. There are fixed points of reference. We even acknowledge that there are fixed points of reference, things that are foundational and solid, but we like being in the river. In fact, we left dry land so long ago that we now have our sea legs to the point where when we get on something solid as a culture, we get shaky. We get nauseous when we find something solid and we reject it. We go, get back into the river, please. We want to get back into that river. That's what I feel like the culture is at right now. I mean, you see all the things that are happening. We have these various things. We have these questions about what it means to be human, where the culture should be going, what morality actually is all about. Is there a fixed point of reference for morality, or is it what human beings themselves make it to be? Do we make it up as we go along, in which case it's not objective anymore? Now it's completely subjective. Something is objective if it's true, regardless of how many people believe it. Like the world is round. I might ruffle a feather or two. I don't know what happened in the past 5 years, but there's a whole flat earth thing. It's a ball, guys. It's a ball. But whether you believe it or not, and when the whole world thought it was flat, it wasn't. That's objective truth. Subjective truth depends on the subject. It depends on your point of view. Something is subjective if you think it's true, but you don't actually know, or even your opinion, like this flavor of ice cream is better than this flavor of ice cream. It's not objectively true that they're better. It's just something that you happen to like, or your music tastes, whatever it is. That's all subjective. Now we're in this river where it's all subjective, and we're balancing these questions of what it means to be human, what it means to be, you know, even we're asking questions, what does it mean to be an oppressor or an oppressed person? These definitions shift because we've lost the referent. We've lost that sort of ontic referent that we can look to. You know, when you think about this amidst the crises that happen in the Middle East, in the Ukraine, in South America, with all the revolutions and counter-revolutions that are happening because of the various corruptions and that's happening, and even in our own country, and we think to ourselves, my goodness, where are we going? There was a song. I'm a child of the 80s. I was born in the 70s, but I remember the 80s. And I don't know if you remember this. Some of you don't remember because you weren't even born yet. Most of you have kids who were in the 80s. Not most of you, but at least some of you. But you'll remember this. Do you remember in the 80s when everyone thought that the United States and the USSR were going to irradiate each other? Do you remember this? Everyone in the Cold War, especially in the 80s, after that movie The Day After, kids had this thing called Cold War neurosis, where they were waking up in the middle of the night screaming because they had these nightmares that the USSR and the USA had finally taken the Cold War and made it nuclear hot. And they had these nightmares about the world ending, and every movie was about the world ending. I don't know if you remember this or not. And in the midst of all the chaos, there was this song by the band called Genesis. It was called Land of Confusion. And in that song, there's this one stanza, and it goes like this: "Oh, Superman, where are you now? When everything's gone wrong somehow, these men of steel, these men of power are losing control by the hour." That was written 40 years ago. That song could be written today. You see, we seem to like being in the river, but the river is the thing that's eroding away all the things that make us what we are. And so it's resulted in the land of confusion. As if to prove the point, in 2016, the word of the year was post-truth. Now, Oxford English Dictionaries names a word of the year every single year. Other dictionaries started taking up the thing, so you'd buy their books. But there's a whole thing called the word of the year. And in 2016, the Oxford English Dictionaries names 2016's word of the year as post-truth. A post-truth world is a world in which appeals to feelings and preferences prevail over appeals to facts and truth. A post-truth world, this is terribly important you understand this, a post-truth world is a world where appeals to feelings and preferences are more persuasive than appeals to facts and truth. Now, I want you to notice something. A lot of times when we talk in this world about where we're at culturally speaking, we often say we're in a postmodern world. We're in a postmodern society. In this postmodern world, how would you answer that? We say these things all the time. We're actually behind the times on this, especially in the church. We're no longer postmodern. Postmodernism died, largely. If it's not dead, it's definitely on life support. Postmodernism was the idea that truth doesn't exist at all. That all we have is perspectives. You have a perspective, I have a perspective. And the postmoderns, amongst many things they tried to do, whether it was Derrida or Foucault or these guys, whatever it was, the postmoderns were trying to say, look, all the wars in the world, all the conflict, all the economic disparities, they're all based on these claims that someone has truth. I claim to have a political truth or an economic truth or a religious truth, whatever it might be, and because I claim to have that truth, I think you should believe it. And so what I'm going to do is take all the might and power that I have and force you to believe that thing because it's good for you. You know, that kind of a thing. So the postmodern says, what we do is, if we get rid of the idea of truth, then no one will try to force it on somebody else because we're all having conversations now instead of conflict. But you see an immediate problem, right? You see the immediate problem? When someone says there's no such thing as truth, it's a self-contradictory statement because the very claim that there is no such thing as truth has to be true itself. And if the claim is true, then truth does exist, in which case the claim is actually wrong. And if there is no such thing as truth, then what you just said isn't true either. And now what? It's all a big jumbled mess. So it dies its death. It dies the death of sawing off the limb on which it sits, only to crash down to the ground. So people recognize this, and that's why postmodernism largely died, I think, I want to say, in the late 90s and early 2000s, postmodernism was dying. What arose from the ashes of postmodernism was the phoenix of post-truth. Post-truth looks the same, but it's subtly different. I want you to hear what the definition is again. A post-truth world is one in which appeals to feelings and preferences matter more than facts and truth. Oh, did you notice the difference? Postmodernism says there is no such thing as truth. Post-truth says there is truth, but I don't care. So you could reason with a postmodern person by showing them how truth actually exists, even under their own worldview. But with a post-truth person, they say, yeah, I heard you. I just don't care. Unless the truth happens to shore up my view, in which case I'm going to use all the evidence I can to show you how you're wrong. But if my preferences happen to conflict with the truth, well, then the truth is racist, bigoted, homophobic, intolerant, or exclusive. And so what ends up happening in a post-truth world is clarity becomes a sin and confusion becomes a virtue. How do you deal with that? How do you deal with that? What I want to do in the time we have is race through, I think, two big points of this, and then there's little minor points along the way. Sounds like a lot, I promise. Well, it is. I'm not going to tell you it's not. It is. But buckle up, because it's really important as the baseline for all we talk about today. The first thing you have to do if you're going to reach a post-truth culture is point out the negative consequences of a post-truth culture. We're a very pragmatic society now. If it works for you, man, you do it. Do whatever works. You do you. We have these kind of phrases, right? So now we have to show, okay, well, you do you and see how that goes. So you have to point out the negative consequences of post-truth thinking. And then, because we are a people of hope, you have to offer them the hope and the beauty that comes from loving truth once again and the freedom that is provided in that. Before I get to that, though, I want to point out something. How did we get here? How did we get to a post-truth society where we're thinking this way? There's several reasons why. In my book, Saving Truth, I go through some of the historical reasons why we got here. But essentially, it's this. It is in the nature of humanity, every single person, man and woman, in this world to be post-truth. All of us, every one of us, including in this room. I can prove it for you biblically. Go to the Adam and Eve story and read it. And look at the Adam and Eve story. God walks and talks with Adam and Eve in the cool of the day. In other words, the whole purpose of our existence is to have relationship with the divine. There can be no greater privilege any human being can possibly experience than to have an intimate relationship with the one in whom all of existence hangs, and he gets to know you and walks and talks with you. Very personal terms. So God creates Adam and Eve, and he puts them in this garden. He says, of all the fruits of the trees of the garden you shall eat, but of the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil you shall not eat, for the day you eat of it you shall surely die. That was the one rule. That's it. We have no idea how long they persisted in that rule and never tempted to violate it once. We have no idea how long they lived with that rule. There's no indication they were tempted until the serpent comes along and says, hey, did God really say? And he misquotes God. And then they respond back and said, oh, no, God said don't even touch it. He never said that. He never said it. They added to his commandment, and that's when the serpent knows, now I've got him, because they want to be the God of God. They're adding things to God's word because they deem themselves to be the sovereign of their own life. And so he says, God knows that when you eat of this tree, you won't die. You'll become like God. And that is suddenly when the fruit becomes desirous. I want you to notice something. The truth of what they were there for was to commune with God. Their preference was to be God. And so the first post-truth people, the people who elevated their preferences over the truth, the first post-truth people were the first people. And you and I are all their progeny. We're made in God's image, just as they were. And they were put in an Edenic setting, quite literally. And we're not in an endemic setting. How much worse off do we have it? You see, the seeds of a post-truth culture were planted in the very first garden. We're just seeing the blossoms now. So every person is essentially post-truth, yours included. If you know my story, I came from a Muslim background, and it took me 9 years to become a Christian, not because the answers were hard to find. I found those answers in 2 years. It took me 7 more years to wrestle with them because my preference was to not be one. And so despite the truth, I decided to shelve that for my own personal desires. Everyone is post-truth to some degree. You see, what happens here, friends, is that Adam and Eve had a quest for divine sovereignty and autonomy. Now, you can tell the health of a culture by how they use certain words and the prevalence of a word in that culture. And probably the most frequently used word in the American experiment, in the Western civilization experiment, about what it means to be in Western civilization is the word freedom. We use this word all the time. We very much use it without any knowledge or depth of understanding what it means. We think it means to do whatever you want, whenever you want, whatever way you want. And that's one aspect of freedom, but there's no moral reference. There's no moral boundary to that freedom. And so we have stopped talking about freedom. We keep using the word, but what we really mean is autonomy. And autonomy is different. Take the two roots of the word autonomy. Autonomy comes from two Greek root words. The first word is autos, meaning self, and the second word is nomos, meaning law. So when you are autonomous, you are a law unto yourself. That means that you have become the autonomous god of your skull-sized world. And in a world where feelings and preferences matter more than facts and truth, when I, as the autonomous sovereign of my own skull-sized world, want you to affirm my preferences, whatever they happen to be, religious, social, identity-wise, sexual, whatever it is, what happens when I, as the sovereign of my world, bump into you, the sovereign of your world, and your preferences and my preferences don't line up? You know what happens? The one who wins isn't the one with truth on their side, because remember, truth exists, but we don't care. And so truth is no longer the weapon. What ends up being the weapon is power. And so the person who wins is not the one with the most reason and rationality on their side. The person who wins is the one with the biggest voice, the biggest platform, the most guns, the most microphones, and the most cameras. So the postmodernists were telling you conflict happens because of truth claims, so get rid of it, and we'll end conflict. The post-truth person says truth exists, but preferences will free you, only to have at least some people enslaved. And so what the postmodernists sought to end, the post-truth people perfected: conflict and subjugation. So how do you deal with that? Let's go to the first part of it. If you point out the negative consequences of a post-truth world, I'm going to race through a couple of these because some will require a little more time, but others will allow us to speed on. The first thing that happens when we sacrifice clarity on the altar of freedom, clarity on the altar of autonomy, is that we lose all ability to reason and our sense of wisdom. Let me give you an example of what I mean. Some years ago, I was giving my testimony about my conversion from Islam to Christianity. And if you've ever heard my testimony, you'll notice something, is that I don't ever talk about how false Islam was. I talk about how true the gospel is, because I didn't know all the stuff about Islam that I know now in terms of some of the history stuff. I knew a lot of it, and I practiced it and all this stuff, but some of the stuff that was troubling, I didn't know. I didn't reject this because it was false. Rather, I embraced the gospel because that was true. I was not repelling the light. I was, the dark. I was attracted to the light. And so what ends up happening is sometimes it gets a little confusing, like, I'm okay with it. I think Islam's fine and it's true. And that's not true. But people think that. So I was giving my testimony, and there was a guy in the front seat, and he was taking furious notes. I mean, he wasn't mad at me or anything. He was just taking notes that kind of like smoke from the page kind of notes, you know. And, you know, that's the kind of person who will eventually come talk to you. The biggest note takers are the ones who come talk to you, usually. And which is my favorite part of what I get to do for a living, is interacting with people directly. So sure enough, I got done with what I had to say, and I sort of walked up from behind where I was speaking, and the guy walks up to me and he says, "Hey, I appreciate the way you didn't disagree with Islam when you talked about your faith." I said, "Well, maybe I didn't communicate that clearly enough. I don't think you got the point, because if I had agreed with Islam or thought it was okay, I would have stayed that way and saved myself and a lot of people I love a whole lot of pain. But I thought this was true." So I get why you say that, but that's not exactly the right thing. He says, well, then, can I show you something? Which is, if you're a public speaker, you know this. When someone comes up to you after a speaking event and they say, can I show you something? That means it's going to be a long conversation. And he had drawn a diagram. And the diagram had in the middle of it this capital T, and he had scribbled it like very boldly. He says, this represents the total and complete objective truth. I believe in that. I said, good, so do I. He says, this is the total truth, and we're trying to get there. So far, you and I are on the same page. He said, but not all of us know, none of us knows all of it. I said, we're also on the same page, because I don't know everything. If I knew everything, then I would be omniscient, and that means I would be God. So far, we're on a great path. I'm not God, and you believe in truth. This is fantastic. Great start. But he had these little lowercase t's that he had surrounded the thing with, these lowercase t's that were pointing towards the capital T. He says, this represents each one of us. Each one of us has a version of the truth, but it's incomplete. And therefore, we're all trying to get to that truth, but all of our versions of the truth are incomplete. And I said, all of us? He said, yes, every human being has an incomplete version of the truth. I said, okay, are they equally valid? And he says, yes, they're all equally valid because compared to the infinite truth, they're all equally incomplete. I said, really? The quality of the truth, does it matter? Like, let's say Pol Pot, Mao Zedong, Adolf Hitler, Idi Amin. I can keep going with all these despots over the course of the history of the world who have these horrible ideologies that have resulted in the deaths of millions and the subjugation of people of different ethnicities and races and religions and creeds. And you're telling me that their version of the truth is as valid as Teresa's or Gandhi's or Jesus's or Muhammad's? Or what? You're saying all these things are equally valid. They're all, he says, yes. He says, this is why. He says, because my version of the truth is incomplete. I cannot disagree with their versions. He said this, I don't prefer their version of the truth, but because my version is incomplete, I can't disagree. So preferences and all this stuff, right? So I said, wait. You're telling me you can't disagree with anybody? He said, that's right. I said, sure you can. He said, no, I can't. I said, you just did it. I was a trial lawyer. I know how to do that kind of thing. But here's a well-meaning man, a thoughtful guy, well-read, and his preference was we all just get along. No one should fight with anybody about their religious differences or their social differences. We're all incomplete, you know, sojourners on the way to truth. I get that sentiment. I get that, and I want to applaud that sentiment, but we can't imbibe in that the preference of that sentiment to the extent that it actually allows us to sacrifice reason and truth. When we say things like all paths lead to God, it sounds incredibly respectful until you realize that not all paths even claim to lead to God, and then suddenly you realize how disrespectful the statement actually is because you didn't take anybody seriously. They don't even claim to lead to God. And I can go into that. We can probably do that during Q&A. But the reality is they don't even all claim to do that. So if you were to tell somebody, you and I believe basically the same thing, and they're like, wait a minute, I have 3,000 years of tradition that says you're wrong. What about that tradition? Do we just like not talk about it? You don't give people the dignity of difference when you do that kind of a thing. We ought to afford them the dignity of disagreeing with them. But we have to do it agreeably. Now, lest you think that this is just individual conversations and has no societal consequences, I'll give you a story about something that happened at a public university. At the University of Missouri, there was a controversy some years ago, I think in 2015, where there was a public protest of some racial issues that had happened on campus, and some of the football players had actually started the protest or were heavily involved in it. And so you got a major college program, you have a major public issue of, you know, racism and these kind of things at a public university. So it's a protest, right? What you want is media attention. But they also had these so-called safe spaces right in the middle of the public area where reporters couldn't go, even though it was on a public university in a public space paid for by tax dollars. So ESPN sends a photojournalist to take pictures of this thing. Just pictures, not interview anybody, just take pictures. And because it's a safe space and reporters aren't allowed near that safe space, which he stood outside of, he was taking photos of the various players and what they were doing. And someone gets involved in this and jumps in front of the camera and tries to get she tries to get the reporter to leave, and she's throwing her hands up and jumping in his way and all this stuff. And eventually she gets so irritated that she calls for some muscle to have the guy physically removed from a public university. So get this, a person on a public university campus is asking for muscle to forcibly remove a journalist from a public taxpayer-funded federal grant receiving public university of a public protest. Do you know what she teaches? She's a professor. Do you know what she teaches at that university? She teaches journalism as a part of the communications department. Here's an otherwise academically gifted and brilliant person. I want to assume that about her. And she's willing to sacrifice her wisdom and her reason and the very basis of her job on the altar of her preference. We lose all sense of reason. Second consequence, when we sacrifice clarity on the altar of our autonomy is we lose all sense of integrity. I'm going to breeze through this one really quickly because there's plenty of things I talk about in the book about the ways in which the so-called even sciences, now they're not so-called sciences, they're real sciences, but the so-called integrity of science is this idea that when you don a lab coat, for some reason you become completely objective about the world and you become immune to post-truth's infection. That just isn't true. Study after study has shown that some of the most prevalent findings published in peer-reviewed academic journals on science, only 40% of the findings in those academic journals could be reproduced. And good science, if you know how the scientific method works, is you have to be able to reproduce your findings so that you can know that your actual methodology was valid. So they found that people's methodologies were either a little funky or they were fudging the numbers, whatever it was, and they could only reproduce less than half of the results, calling on a crisis of what was going on. The post-truth issue was, the preference was to be published and have sexy headlines and all these things and get the grant money to fund good research. I get the desire to get the money so you can get the good research done, but at the expense of truth, that's the whole scientific endeavor. Now, this is the hard part I think we're all going to have to get a little bit self-reflective on. Lest we start to say they always get it wrong. And by the way, they is never us. I don't know how that happens. But they is never me. In 2015, the Obergefell decision happened. The Supreme Court of the United States legalized same-sex marriage across the United States. Do you remember this? Of course you do. Now, I'm a lawyer and an apologist. And what ended up happening when Obergefell was made headlines is my inbox got flooded and my social media started popping up with a certain story and asking me for my response to a certain story. It was a story about a gay activist who had sued two Christian publishers over their publication of the Bible, and he sued them in federal court to get the Bible banned as hate speech because now it violates the Constitution because the Supreme Court has said that same-sex marriage is legal in the United States and it's constitutional. And so any document that goes against this is somehow unconstitutional. And so people were saying, my goodness, it didn't take them long. We knew this was going to happen. As soon as Obergefell happened, we knew this was going to become a precedent to suppress your religious freedom. And I thought to myself, that sounds wrong. Something fishy about that. So I did some research. It took me 3 minutes, a commercial's break worth of time, to do the research to find out it wasn't true. What had happened was a gay man did in fact sue two Christian publishers in federal court. He didn't get to seek the Bible banned. He asked the court to force those publishers to retranslate the Bible to be same-sex marriage affirming. And that case was dismissed within 30 days of its filing as frivolous. And you know when it was filed? It wasn't filed after Obergefell. It was filed 7 years before Obergefell. I know the judge. And Christians were the ones who were circulating the story as if it were true. Friends, the post-truth infection is pretty insidious. You inoculate yourself with the love of truth. And if we are those who follow the way, the truth, and the life, that means that your way must be life-giving and truthful. I know there's a panic in the social media world where a lie can get halfway around the world before the truth has a chance to put up its shoes. But you can't succumb to the need to rush to judgment. Truth is slow sometimes, but it gets there. Lava is slow too, and it will devour an entire city if it's not stopped. Truth will win. Don't sacrifice your integrity. Third thing we lose, before I go on to the hope, is we lose our sense of accountability and human value. When we become the autonomous masters of our own universe, we lose all sense of accountability and therefore human value. You know, it was the philosopher and the Greek thinker Pythagoras who said that human beings are the measure of all things. Man is the measure of all things, he's famous for saying. There are no gods above us to which we are subject. We have no obligation to them. We are the sole arbiters of what's true and what's right and what's beautiful and all these things. Man is the measure of all things. So it all becomes very subjective. You know, there's no overarching objective duty we owe to an overarching objective authority. So we see that. Tom Flynn, this is not a new concept, but Tom Flynn is repeating Pythagoras, but in very, very secular humanist terms. I want you to hear what he says. He says, secular humanism maintains that through a process of value inquiry informed by scientific and reflective thought, men and women can reach rough agreement concerning values, crafting ethical systems that deliver optimal results for human beings across a broad spectrum of circumstances. That's a fancy-dancy way of saying man is the measure of all things. Now, I want you to notice something. Through reflective thought and scientific inquiry, we can reach a rough agreement concerning values. If you turn on the news or you open up your device and find out whatever source you have now for news, you'll find something out. Where is this rough agreement concerning values? Where is this? You know what's happened? We've simply agreed on the value of being rough. And so we cancel each other. And we have protests at colleges that shout people down before they even have a chance to speak. We don't respond with counter speech. No, we don't even let them speak at all. We have laws. I don't know if you're aware of the law in Scotland that was passed was passed a couple of years ago, but put into force very, very recently on April Fool's Day. That's probably poetic. That criminalizes certain speech as hate speech with a fine of a fine and an imprisonment sentence of up to 7 years if what you say stirs up hatred against certain groups. I don't know what stirs up hatred actually means. And by the way, the defense against, if you're charged with a crime, you can say, well, I defend against it because my speech was reasonable. That's a weird standard today. Reasonable in a world where we can say that someone is completely biologically male, but we will say that they're actually female and allow them to box or get in MMA fights with other women and break the mask of their face. That happened. Fallon Fox, look it up. And say, you know what? Totally fair. That's the world where reasonableness is the standard to get you out of a hate crime? Seems like a very almost an impossible standard. You see, what ends up happening is that as I, the autonomous god of my skull-sized world, get offended when you disagree with me because now my ideas equate to me. And I have the unfettered freedom to do whatever I want, say whatever I want, be whatever I want. And if you say, no, you don't, now we have a fight and you therefore have to be subjugated and you're less than me. I can cancel you. I can ruin you. I can do all these things. Violently attack you. It's happened all over the place. It's the kind of place where, yes, there are Palestinians who have suffered horribly and over the past years, but there's also people who were kidnapped, children who were kidnapped, and then we can go and see the Jewish kids' pictures on the walls in various places in the United States, and then activists will tear their pictures down. What did that kid have to do with anything? But they got in the way. And yes, we do value the lives of every person equally, or at least we should. But you notice something? We no longer do. So you can be anti-Semitic with no consequences, and you can be anti-Arab with almost no consequences. Because they happen to get in the way of what I feel at the particular moment I feel it. You know, it was Alexander Pope who called this out in his Essays on Man. He says, go wiser thou, and in thy scale of sense, weigh thy opinion against providence. Call imperfection what thou fanciest such. Say here God gives too little, but there too much. Destroy all creatures for thy sport or gust, yet cry if man's unhappy, well then God's unjust. If man alone engross not heaven's highest care, alone made perfect here, immortal there, snatch from his hand the balance and the rod, rejudge his justice, become the God of God. And when you do that, what ends up happening is this. People are ethicists, bioethicists with a straight face can actually argue and publish papers Alberto Giubilini and Francesca Minerva out of Australia, or Peter Singer out of Princeton University can say with a straight face that they're okay with abortion up to birth. In fact, they're actually okay with you killing a child within months of its birth. After its birth. Because the child only has value if the parents, specifically the mother, gives that child value. And so if you have a three-month-old baby that can't realize its own sense of value, therefore it has no value unless someone else values it. So if the baby can't value itself and no one else in the world values that baby, it therefore has no value and then can be killed. That's the logic. And I got news for you, friends. If there's no God, they're right. But if there is a God, that baby has a value because it's made in God's image, regardless of human opinion. And that's where we lead. Those are the three things that happen in a post-truth culture, amongst many others. But we need to come to the hope. We need to come to the hope. I'm going to race through this, so hopefully we'll get maybe 10 minutes or so of questions, if we can. But the hope is real. I'm actually not a pessimist. I know it sounds like I am. That was a lot of doom and gloom just now. But I'm actually not a pessimist. I've spoken at these places. I'm telling you what, I've gone to Berkeley, and they haven't lit anything on fire. They didn't throw anything through windows. They didn't blow up any cars. They didn't get us kicked off. I didn't get one threat. I spoke at Yale on this very topic. Nothing. They showed up. They showed up a lot, and they disagreed at the microphones. But they let me speak. University of Michigan. I was just at MIT. I spoke on the topic I'll be speaking at in the afternoon at MIT. The most brilliant minds in the world come to this one place for engineering and science. You know, in the Q&A, they didn't ask me one science question. And I raised science as an issue. Science and faith. The science book got out of a job kind of a thing. I raised that as part of my topic. All the questions centered on morality, meaning, the nature of truth, are all religions the same or not, and sexuality. It's the meaning questions. And they asked with the attitude of, I want an answer. You see, I think our young people have gone on the post-truth bender and are now in the grisly hangover and don't want more of the hair of the dog. I think they actually want a remedy that's true. That's true. The first thing you have to show them is that freedom, based on their definition of autonomy, of do whatever you want, whenever you want, whatever way you want, and be what you want, none of that works. It results in the chaos I just described. Rather, freedom has to have limits. I know that's an unpopular statement now, but I want to give you an illustration of what I mean by this. Freedom has to have limits. It has to. It was G.K. Chesterton who said that even art is limited. We may think that we have the freedom to draw a giraffe with a short neck, only to find ourselves not free to draw a giraffe at all. You may try to take a hump from the camel, but find out you haven't even let it be a camel in the first place. You may try to free a tiger from his bars, but you dare not free a tiger from his stripes, because now you've freed him from the very essence of what it means to be a tiger in the first place. Even art has limitations. The frame is there. And it locks the picture in. Freedom has to have limitations. You know, my wife and I, when we were looking to buy a house, the house we're living in now, but at the time we were looking to buy a house, my son wasn't even a year old yet. We wanted to have, you know, more kids. And one of the things you want is a backyard that's the kind of backyard your kids can play in. You can just watch them play or let them play in there, you know, without unsupervised, all that kind of stuff. You need that. It's a good thing. That's the whole purpose of a backyard. Is to enjoy it and have the freedom to enjoy it. That's the purpose of it. But here's the problem with the backyard we were looking at. The house we were looking at had backed up to a main road, and there were cars and trucks whizzing by at quite a speed. And kids being kids won't look both ways when the ball bounces in the road or whatever it is. They'll go after it, and they get pulverized. So the kids, without any boundaries, will have no freedom to enjoy the purpose of the backyard. But the backyard could be enjoyed, and we finally decided to have this, is that there is a boundary. There's a boundary beyond which you cannot cross. If you cross this boundary, you can't play here anymore, and all that kind of thing. So the kids knew that there was a boundary. The freedom to enjoy the backyard had to have a boundary, lest the kids be pulverized. And without that boundary, the kids couldn't enjoy the purpose of the backyard. I want you to notice something, is that freedom and purpose are inextricably linked. Freedom and purpose are linked. but they have to have some kind of a boundary. And what I want to suggest to you, friends, is the boundary to give us true freedom is truth. Anything that's false, we have the freedom to imbibe in that thing and to entertain that thing and even stumble through that thing, but ultimately we don't find real freedom until we find the collective truth. I can show it to you right from the Bible. Jesus' own words, John chapter 8, verse 31 to 36. And you know this passage. I'm going to race through it because you know it so well. So Jesus said to the Jews who had believed him, "If you abide in my word, you are truly my disciples, and you will know the truth, not feel the truth, not prefer the truth. You will know the truth, and the truth will set you free." Did you catch that? The first coupling I want you to notice is this. Truth and freedom. You will know the truth, and the truth will set you free. That means truth and freedom cannot be separated. They're linked. That's the first thing. Their answer, by the way, is hilarious. It's actually hilarious when you think about it. We are offspring of Abraham and have never been enslaved to anyone. Can you be serious? That whole Passover thing you celebrate every year, never enslaved to anyone. My point here is this. Post-truth thinking has a way of distorting your view of your own history. Jesus answered them, "Truly, truly, I say to you, everyone who practices sin is a slave to sin. The slave does not remain in the house forever. The son remains forever. So if the son sets you free, you will be free indeed." Did you catch that coupling? If the truth sets you free and the son sets you free, the son is the truth. He claims to be the truth. Now that's the kind of thing you can't just say. You got to back that thing up. And they asked him in John chapter 2, "Who do you think you are? By what authority do you do these things?" And he says, "When I die, when you kill me, basically, you destroy this temple, I will raise it up again in 3 days. I will raise up my body again in 3 days." That's an objective truth. It's not based on feelings. It's not like, well, when you kill me, my teachings will live on. When you kill me, my wisdom will be undeniable. I have really pretty songs. None of that stuff. It's objective. It's verifiable. In fact, it's falsifiable. If Jesus was wrong, you could prove it. He said, that grave won't be full, it'll be empty. And then it was. People often ask me, why do you trust Jesus with all these things as opposed to anybody else? Muhammad or Buddha or Confucius or Mao or Marx or whatever. Why? All those men died and they're still that way. They all died and they stayed dead. Jesus rose from the dead. And here's my answer to why Jesus above everybody else. Because guys who rise from the dead tend to have credibility. If they say something's true and it's proven that they did it, I can believe it. I can believe it. The power of the gospel has this clarity for the foundation of human value. The clarity for the foundation of human value. You see, a young guy comes up to the microphone at Yale after I was done giving the talk. He says, "You know, I get this. I get why truth and freedom are linked, but you brought Jesus into it. How does Jesus factor into this whole truth and freedom thing and who I really am and my purpose and my identity and all this? How does he factor in?" And then he says, "And does the resurrection have anything to do with it?" What a question. I'm so glad he asked. I told him that. I'm so glad you asked. Because now I got to end with the gospel. And I said to him this. I said, "You know, a naturalistic framework, a framework within which there's no God, tells you that you are the flotsam and the jetsam of the universe. You're just a cosmic accident. There is no prevision for your creation. You have no purpose. There is no purpose for your creation whatsoever. You are here by accident, and whatever meaning is in life, you forge it, but it's completely subjective, and when you're gone, that meaning is gone. Jesus says you are made in the image of God, which means that the very foundation of all of existence values you. That means it's objective. Even if no human being in the world valued you, you'd still have value. But he made you for a purpose, and that purpose was to commune with him. And through our own sin, we marred that purpose. We took that image that was put on, in which we were made, and we somehow distorted it in some way. And Jesus doesn't leave you to that. He says to you, "I will fix this. I will clean this up. So when my Father looks at you, he will see me and see the image that I bear, and I bear it perfectly without blemish." Now, he made that claim. He comes to set you free from the thing that keeps you from being what you were supposed to be, which was a being who is made in God's image and enjoys communion with him. Do you see what I'm saying here? I said, purpose. Your purpose is communion with God, and until you live in your purpose, you have no freedom. But you and I have marred our ability to do that, and so Jesus comes to restore that purpose so that you have freedom, and the death on the cross pays for it. And his rising from the dead 3 days later proves he was right. If he died and stayed dead, you'd have no reason to trust him. But he didn't die and stay dead. He rose from the dead, which means you have every reason to trust him and him alone. So he gives you your purpose back, which gives you your freedom. You see, friends, freedom is not the ability to do what you want, whenever you want, in whatever way you want, or be what you want. Freedom is the ability to do what you want in accordance with what you should, the objective moral law, based on what you are, made in God's image. When you have those three things, you don't have the chaos of a post-truth world. You have the harmony of a world based in truth. You know, he liked my answer. He liked that because it's the gospel. Let me close with a quote, if you don't mind my doing so. Hopefully we'll a minute or two for questions. It's a quote from a secular band. It's a song called Rain Delays. The band is called Crash Parallel. I have permission to quote it in its full, and I quote it in my book. Secular band writing about our need for fulfillment and how we look to things to find our own personal truths, and we look to things that are neither personal nor true. And we end up crying over the whole thing. Says this: sleepless nights and endless days and mini skirts and serving trays and selling sex for pocket change and raking up from rain delays and living off the alcohol with no one but a cab to call, lost inside a bathroom stall, this carbon copy life withdrawal, and driving cars we can't afford, just making sure we're never bored, living off our own accord between coffee grounds and corner stores, limousines and cigarettes and chasing dreams with fishing nets and long weekends without regrets. Well, no one here is taking bets. I need someone to believe in, someone to fill this space with grace, to look into my eyes and touch my face, someone to make me strong, someone to make me belong, someone to make me alive. The gospel is such a powerful message, we tell it by accident. They recognize the need. In a world that's looking for personal truths, they can look to the one who makes them strong, makes them belong, and makes them alive, because personal truths don't exist. But the person who is the truth, he is the one who exists. God bless you guys. Let's take some questions.